And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The heat continues. Good old Mother Earth appears to be turning into one big hot mama. And it may be that she's getting back at us for questioning whether or not Mama Earth is getting hotter. It is hot across the country. And trying to be fair and balanced, today we look at what it may mean that our new energy bill is about to be passed in Washington, D.C. And then we cool off as we head to the land of enchantment outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and talk with a naturalist, artist, and man of the earth when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
In a few days, it's going to be August. We're entering what some people think is the best time of summer, when the heat just keeps on coming, when cold drinks and air conditioning, swimsuits, and heading to the high country is what the season is made of. It's summer, and some people are saying it's a record hot one, but then almost every time it gets hot, I mean really hot, everyone says it's a record setter. Gives us something to talk about, and talking about the weather ends up being a relief from talking about the terror. Today, we take a look at the news, then do an in-depth analysis of what that means to all of us. Then in segment two, we talk with the current director of the Apollo Alliance, which has been working hard to get a real energy policy to set America free from foreign sources, and what the compromise energy bill that is about to be passed by the Senate and House and sent off to the President means to their dreams and our future. And then in segment three, we take a well-deserved break, head on up to the high country of New Mexico, and talk with the naturalist and artist, Rourke Griffin, whose paintings of American raptors and the lands they inhabit are getting some attention by some pretty serious collectors. That's all coming up, so we'd better keep it cool by getting moving on today's show. But as always, we catch up on the news first. So now, the news. It looks as if Friday is the day when the House and Senate will have worked out all the details of our nation's new national energy bill. In the final moments of negotiation, a few compromises were struck. The $11 billion bill provides significant breaks for the old energy family, the oil, gas, and coal industries, breathes new energy into the nuclear industry, and puts a lot of emphasis on ethanol from corn, while new energy, wind, solar, and others, are provided with just enough funding to make things feel better. First and foremost, the bill moves the start of daylight savings time in 2007 from the first Sunday in April to the second in March, and extends it by 1 week to the first Sunday in November. Now that's exciting and bold. It bans drilling in the Great Lakes, but supports a complete inventory of all coastal waters for energy production. The new energy bill provides a tremendous support for the development of nuclear by offering a $2 billion insurance plan to cover delays in building 6 new nuclear power reactors, and provides $1.3 billion for an experimental reactor in Idaho that will produce hydrogen. The new energy bill permits power lines running across federal lands, while dropping a provision that would have required U.S. utilities to generate 10% of their electricity from renewable sources such as wind and solar by 2020. That's 15 years from now. We will cover this topic in depth during our second segment. Some good news from the Senate this past week. The U.S. Senate unanimously passed 4 conservation measures that will preserve some of the country's most wild and scenic areas, as they preserved 4 significant areas as wilderness in California, New Mexico, Washington State, and Puerto Rico. This unusual unanimity over wilderness was eclipsed by the inclusion of the first Caribbean National Forest Act, which designates 10,000 acres of forest in Puerto Rico. the new El Toro Wilderness, the first tropical forest wilderness in the U.S., is home to the endangered Puerto Rican parrot, one of the most threatened species in the world. As well, the bill includes the Northern California Coastal Wild Heritage Wilderness, preserving the largest stretch of undeveloped coastline in the lower 48 states, as well as the Ojito Wilderness in New Mexico, which is the largest wilderness set aside in that state in over 18 years. And Washington State now has the Wild Sky Wilderness, an hour's drive from Seattle, and which preserves the classic nature of wilderness, alpine peaks, cascading waterfalls, old-growth forests, and pristine rivers. The passage of this legislation is of particular interest to numerous environmental journalists and historians who will dissect this unanimous wilderness set-aside for years to come. And speaking of researching, that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker, which managed to stay hidden for over 60 years, but which recently made big news by coming out of the forest? Well, now, there is an emerging debate as to whether or not the sightings of the rarest of birds was, in actuality, sightings of the rarest bird. It seems some researchers are pecking away at the certainty by arguing that the video used as proof of the sighting could, in fact, be used to prove a sighting of a wonderful but not endangered pileated woodpecker. This debate will continue until further notice. If by chance this voice of the earth can be heard down there in Arkansas and our ivory-billed friend is listening, please save us all a lot of anxiety and show yourself, if you actually exist. And in New York City, the yellow cab is turning green. That is, New York cabbies have been given the green light to buy hybrid cabs for their fleets. Pending approval in September, the Big Apple will do its part to become the Big Green Apple, as perhaps thousands of cabs begin appearing to replace the gas-guzzling Crown Victorias. Although the new cabs will not be as spacious and may end up costing more in the short term, in the long term, generally getting better than twice the gas mileage of the Crown Victoria, passengers, New Yorkers, and the future of the Earth will all benefit from this administrative move. And that's today's news. And now, a few announcements. If you're new to the Wild Side News, be sure to take a walk in the archives and explore the many wonders and voices from shows past. Simply click on the archives page and search by topic, or from the front page, type in a keyword and see what comes up. If you'd like to be added to our weekly show announcement, which comes out each Wednesday, just in time for you to wake up and see what's on Thursday's show, just send an email to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.NET. And ask to be added to our list. And while you're in it, feel free to send us your thoughts about nature, the outdoors, your joys, concerns, and show ideas. I always enjoy hearing from you. Now, on with the show. In segment two, we go in-depth with a new national energy bill with Jeff Rickert of the Apollo Alliance. Then off to talk with an artist whose fascination is raptors and who paints from his studio outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico. But now I'd like to take a look and a few things that I think we need to think about. You know, it's fun to poke fun at the foibles of science, as in the new controversy about the existence of the ivory-billed woodpecker, but it really gets to the heart of something much more significant, namely, the importance of preserving the great diversity of animals on our Earth. This week, California's Congressman and House Resources Chairman, Representative Richard Pombo, he's a Republican from California, is introducing legislation which will, through time, effectively destroy the Endangered Species Act. Now, obviously, the Endangered Species Act has received plenty of bad press, and to be fair, the issue of whether a spotted owl species is more important than the livelihoods of hundreds and sometimes thousands of workers is a battle that has no clear good guys and bad guys. And that is the way it will always be. But the bottom line is this. If it weren't for the Endangered Species Act, there would likely be no bald eagles, grizzly bears, wolves, or condors in the lower 48 states. And most Americans are, whether they can actually admit it, happy that these animals are still part of our landscape. But there is another level to the story. The fact that these exceptionally notable species exist shadows the fact that they exist because actions were taken to preserve, restore, and expand their habitats. In that process, whole ecosystems have been preserved. And to some extent, that is a very significant story, because within those whole ecosystems, hundreds and thousands of minor creatures have been permitted to exist, ones which will never achieve acknowledgement as an endangered species. And then, at an even larger level, when we talk about ecosystems being preserved, we're really talking about keeping vast areas of our nation intact. Had it not been for the Endangered Species Act, who knows how little of our forests might still be standing? Who knows just how polluted our rivers and lakes might be now? The Endangered Species Act has provided one of the most important means of protecting not simply a snail darter or an Allegheny wood rat, but more importantly, all of the species that are tied into that animal's survival, and ultimately to the integrity of the mystery of life that not a single person I know will ever be able to fully explain. So when it comes to Senator Pombo's efforts to construct whole levels of obstructionist rules and regulations that make it almost impossible to ever get an endangered species listed, I say he must really put himself somewhere at the level of God or the Creator, because I guess he feels he knows enough about this mystery to get his will right into the middle of things he will never understand. There are plenty of places to find out more about Mr. Pombo's newly drafted legislation. Certainly, Defenders of Wildlife will get you started at www.defenders.org. And there are things that you can do, and I invite you to contact Representative Pombo's office and ask for answers. To help you, here is his contact information in Washington, D.C. His office phone is 202-225-1947. His fax is 202-226-0861. And his email is rpombo@mail.house.gov. I also extend an open invitation to Representative Pombo to talk with me here on the Wild Side News about this issue, and I will contact his office to invite him on the show personally. I'll tell you what is beginning to bother me most about some of the things going on right now, and that is that decisions are being made that I know in my heart and mind will forever, and I mean forever, impact my pursuit of happiness in my country. The idea that I am being forced against my will to accept the prospect of the destruction of the wondrous mystery of beauty and splendor, the magnificence of the communication with nature, the joy of the natural landscape, and ultimately the healthy manifestation of life on earth is, to say the least, getting really old. I keep working each week to speak for the earth, to raise the voice of the earth in defense of those who cannot speak. And I invite you all to join me, as you are now, on your Voice of the Earth. When we return, we continue an exploration of the limits of our livelihoods being crafted by leaders who seem to have lost their wisdom. When we return, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
The House and Senate are getting ready to take a vote on the National Energy Bill that was agreed to this last week. With gasoline prices settling in at record prices and no whisper that they will ever again recede much below these levels, many Americans held the belief that once passed, this National Energy Bill would address things like our high oil, gas, and heating oil prices, and of course, our dependence on Middle East sources of oil. When we return, we head on out to Washington, D.C., and talk with the new director of the Apollo Alliance about the National Energy Bill. It's a good thing to know what Apollo is saying, because a lot of people are listening and signing up. We hear that and more when we return with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wildside News. It's just about done, our new national energy bill, the long-awaited dream come true of the Bush administration to once and for all get us on the right track towards real energy independence. Now joining us from Washington, D.C. is Jeff Rickert. And Jeff, you're with the Apollo Alliance. You're newly kind of taking over the helms of the Apollo Alliance. Tell us what your new position is.
I'm the interim executive director of Apollo Alliance.
What I'd like to really focus on today is the new energy bill that's about, it's probably going to be passed Friday or something like that by the House and the Senate, and your thoughts, particularly as it relates to the dream and mission of the Apollo Alliance.
Well, we really see this as a failure of leadership on the part of Congress to come up with, to set a federal energy policy that would give us some relief from the skyrocketing gas prices, give us some protection or, you know, sense of security by weaning us off our dependence on foreign oil. And, it, you know, just a lost opportunity to create a real program that could accomplish both of those things while, you know, revitalizing our economy and creating millions of new jobs here in the U.S.
For people who may not be familiar with the Apollo Alliance, why don't you tell us what your real mission has been in the past, and then also I'm curious how you're facing the new realities today.
The Apollo Alliance is a coalition of labor unions, environmentalists, civil rights groups, and business dedicated to driving a bold federal investment into achieving sustainable energy independence in a way that will create millions of new jobs in the United States. It's named Apollo, harkening back to President Kennedy's commitment to put him, you know, when he rallied the country to commit to putting a man on the moon in less than a generation.
And you have an extraordinary coalition of people that have come together to try to move this forward, because I know that every time that I mention the concept of the Apollo Alliance, people get it, which I thought was one of the brilliant strokes of the Apollo Alliance. Almost everybody wants what you guys want. But somehow this vision keeps, it's there and it's growing, but somehow our leadership is failing us so totally. I couldn't agree with you more. What's bringing this about?
What makes this so shocking on the part of Congress to pass up this opportunity is the broad support publicly. I mean, a recent Yale poll said that 92% of Americans consider energy independence to be a serious issue. I think, you know, certainly prices at the pump impact people's perspective on this, and certainly against the backdrop of a war that, you know, we hear about every single day. Against, you know, the other backdrop of an economy that's stopped creating jobs for working people. And so when you can combine all of these things really into sort of one program, it really resonates with people. Not to mention, you know, the growing concern over global warming and climate risk.
One of the things that shocked me about the new energy bill is the way in which nuclear seems to be the new fat cat, or pretty boy, or something in between. What are your thoughts on that?
I find it interesting that it's come back so rapidly as a issue in this round of the energy bill. We, you know, Apollo doesn't really take a position on nuclear one way or another, though clearly we would could only possibly support nuclear if they found out, you know, figured out ways for dealing with waste and ensuring that they run safely. A number of the national security folks that are advocating for this do so because they see it as a way to get us off foreign oil by figuring out new ways to power cars through plug-in hybrids, fuel cells, et cetera, and feel like that's the only way to get to scale, to get to the scale of electricity generation that it would take to power that transition.
It still maintains a centralized power network and,
right,
and control in one place, and the distribution, as always, and that to me is going in the wrong direction.
Right, and I think that you could achieve the same bang for your buck by bringing to scale renewable energy and like wind farms and solar.
Well, just for example, one of the elements of the new energy bill spends $1.3 billion for an experimental Idaho reactor that would also produce hydrogen fuel. And fair enough, that's okay. But $1.3 billion put directly into solar,
right,
or other alternative forms would really start moving this forward. And, you know, from my reading of this, that doesn't exist in this current energy bill.
Right. That's precisely right.
That's what bothers me. And it has to do with the way in which the priorities, once again, huge chunks of money, limited money that we're all trying to figure out how in the world we're going to pay for these things, are ending up being spent on such things as nuclear and tax relief for oil and gas, and that's the frustrating thing. Fair enough, they can have that, but I do believe that we need to power up. I'm speaking now my my message here, but I just can't. I'm actually almost depressed about it. I had expected and hoped for so much more, and quite honestly, as far as I can see, this is doing nothing to bring about, very little to bring about energy independence anywhere in the near future.
Yeah, it's tragic, really. I mean, especially at a time when the country faces such profound challenges, and you're debating what is the federal program on energy, and to have that come out in the wash. You know, the Senate, there were interesting changes in the debate in the Senate bill, but even though that modest, extraordinarily modest progress got washed out in the final conference bill, which is just amazing.
Well, so now, where does this put the Apollo Alliance? Because obviously the leadership is absolutely not coming, and I have to fault both sides. I'm talking about the House and the Senate, the Democrats and the Republicans, for somehow dropping this ball so incredibly, and just from my own perspective, I'm really tired of this. I really feel kind of personally affected by the fact that our leadership is literally putting my future at stake because they're not willing to truly lead. And these are my friends and others who just aren't doing the job. So where do we go from here? How do we deal with this?
Right. Well, I think there are those people who are willing to lead and have started to. You know, obviously we don't see that leadership coming at the federal level right now, but clearly in the states and cities across the country, things are already begun to change. And governors are stepping up across the country in both parties to develop renewables industries, to, you know, support efficiency programs, pass green building codes that ensure that all new public buildings will be built to a certain standard that will be improve our energy efficiency, but also have all sorts of other great environmental impacts.
How are these progressive, and progressive meaning both, as you say, both on the Republican and the Democratic sides, because they're truly progressive in terms of bringing about the change that we must have to get past these times and to develop into a sustainable world somehow and nation. Talk to me about how are they working together? How are they formulating an effective alliance that can pool their resources and their wills and vision to start to creating a critical mass to move us forward?
Well, clearly, there have been a number of regional state compacts to figure out this problem and how do you make a uniform system across states on the same policy platforms, building the same industries. And clearly the front runner in this is the Western Governors Association, who passed a clean energy program, who endorsed a clean energy program last year, spearheaded by Governor Bill Richardson of New Mexico and Arnold Schwarzenegger of California, which is an odd pairing, but both seeing the pressing demands for new energy solutions. Now, if you look within the states, you know, coalitions of environmentalists, labor unions, urban activists have come together to pass legislation along the same lines of each other. And I think, you know, we've seen some small progress this year, and I expect to see a lot more next year on this. Washington State activists there were able to work out a compromise on a green building code that was going to be opposed by labor. And then working together and working with the state legislature, they were able to come up with a compromise that took out one aspect of the bill that labor thought was going to cost them jobs around the certification of the forests that produce, that supply the wood for public buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at another time, that compromise might not have been possible. But as the situation becomes more pressing, I think it's not even looking at the negative part about it. It's like you can see the challenge, but then in seeing that challenge, you also see the opportunity. And I think everyone has come around to saying, you know, it just makes sense to invest in new energy infrastructure because you get jobs, affordable energy, a better environment, and a safer world.
It seems to me that kind of a part of the new paradigm for this type of mission is really to quit fighting and just start working and creating together, because we expend too much energy sometimes, too much of our resources in trying to counter, when in reality, if we were to pool our energies and spirit and money and just invest in our future, we could just do it, because that actually is a legal thing to do in America, to invest in a better future.
Right. And it's a safe investment, an investment that's virtually guaranteed to pay off in benefits, you know, beyond the bottom line.
Why don't you go ahead and give some of the numbers that you've the Apollo Alliance likes to talk about in terms of what could happen to the American economy and jobs, really, if this became a mission, an American mission, which I hope someday it will. But if that were to happen, what would we really be looking at?
Yeah, when we first started, we did a job modeling exercise based on a figure that investing $300 billion over the next 10 years in a new energy infrastructure, you know, a figure that is, you know, roughly the same as what we've spent in 2 years on the Iraq war. And with that, from that kind of investment, you would create 3 million new jobs, $1 trillion in new economic activity, and that new economic activity would easily pay back the initial investment.
And it would also keep us at pace with the rest of the world, which is moving so quickly ahead. I know I'm, for example, working on a solar system here in the United States that really has a terrific amount of promise. And the interest is coming from China and South Korea and Germany and other places like that. And it's difficult, unfortunately, to get the level of interest that we should here. We have to compete. And in order to do so, we just simply have to invest in our future. It is the way to go. I, like you, I couldn't believe, quite honestly, that we could, at this point in history, with so much pointing to the requirement that we really address energy independence, alternative forms of energy, removing our reliance from the Middle East for our oil, and just because this is an opportunity that we could so completely drop the ball and not do a thing to alleviate the extraordinary cost at the pump for a gallon of gas, but as well, really having no true vision or way to move forward to energy independence. But expand on that. I'd like to hear your thoughts on where this is at this point. And then also, what can people do?
You know, I think if the bill passes on Friday, which I suspect it will, we're going to be left with an energy bill that sets the federal policy for the next 10 years. And all that really means is that for the next 10 years, we're going to be putting together piecemeal legislation to address a problem that's only going to get worse on all fronts. And so it's, you know, a tragic opportunity. It's tragic that the opportunity we had was passed by, and now we're going to be playing catch-up for, you know, a while. It's not that we can't catch up, because I think that we can, but we've missed the opportunity for another year at least until we were able to go back to Congress and say, give us something real. You know, as far as what people can do, I think the thing that we're most focused on is getting our state legislation passed in the next year so that at least, you know, we're not standing still, we're making progress. And so identifying, you know, the places where we have opportunities to really push something, contacting legislators, contacting city council people, and, you know, spreading the message about the kind of energy plan we want will be very important now until we have this problem under hand.
We're talking with Jeff Rickert with the Apollo Alliance. Jeff, here's another thought, too. Recently, another Nation magazine is really taking a strong stand for the Apollo Alliance. They recently wrote an article that said that 8 governors have signed on to the Apollo Alliance vision. Why don't you tell us who those governors are, and people in those states should contact their governors and support them, but also it will give people an idea of the modeling that's beginning to develop at the state level.
Great. Actually, it was 7 governors. Governor Gregoire of Washington, Governor Kulongoski of Oregon, Governor Napolitano of Arizona, Governor Richardson of New Mexico, Governor Doyle of Wisconsin, Governor Blagojevich of Illinois, and Governor Schweitzer of Montana. And Governor Rendell and Governor Granholm last year also signed a letter of support with Governor Richardson in the fall. And on all of those states, we have, or places where we hope to have, innovative legislation moving forward next year.
Well, Jeff Rickert, I want to thank you for giving your thoughts. And by the way, this, I'm sure as you know, the Wildside News is here to serve your mission, because it's my mission. And it's the mission of my friends and my family and everybody that I can think of for us to move forward. So anytime you wish, you're welcome to give voice here on the Wildside News.
Great. Thanks a lot, Sid.
Thanks, Jeff.
Let's take a well-deserved break from all this political stuff and reconnect with the real nature of nature. When we return, we talk with artist and birder and man about town, Rourke Griffin. When we head to Roe, New Mexico, population, maybe 100, where he lives and paints the wonders of his world, when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
One of the great things about life is its diversity. And one place that seems to foster and nurture diversity is New Mexico. That's where we're headed, outside of the legendary art capital of the Southwest and site of some of the most ancient cultures of long ago, which still carry on in their ancestral homes. When we return, we head east out of Santa Fe to Roe, New Mexico, where a lifelong birder turned artist paints the kings and queens of the wind, the raptors of the high desert. When we return, with your voice of the earth, here on the Wild Side News. Almost anyone who ever visits the Santa Fe area of New Mexico is awakened to the power of the land and the power the land has on its people. Today, we visit with a painter of birds in the land he loves.
We live in a most amazing planet. As everyone knows, my belief is that this is an expression of something close to divine. It's truly a miracle. And there are many people who experience this in a lot of different ways. And joining us now is someone who lives it and breathes it day and night. This is Rourke Griffin, who is from Roe, New Mexico, which is outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Rourke, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you, Sid. Nice hearing from you.
You bet. Now, hey, first of all, let's find out what things feel like in Roe today.
Well, actually, the weather today is somewhat cool. We had a little cool front drop in, and the temperature is about 10 degrees cooler than it has been. So 10 degrees right now cooler, we're talking about maybe 78 degrees, maybe 80 by the time the day's done. But the clouds are moving in. We might get a little start of our monsoon everybody's anticipating, hopefully.
Well, that's a beautiful country. If anybody hasn't been to Roe, I highly encourage them to do so. And then you'd be able to see actually what inspires Rourke, because Rourke is a painter. He's an artist and a painter. He's also a musician. He works with his hands, but he also works a lot with his spirit and his soul. And that's kind of what I'd like to talk about, Rourke, because I know that you have a real dedication and a real connection with animals and the land and things like that. I'd like to really find out how it is that this love affair with nature began.
Well, I was young. I was living in the valley of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I became involved with falconry, and I started collecting books on the sport, and started appreciating birds of prey, and of course started raising a young kestrel, which is a sparrowhawk, and started flying that bird around my yard and experiencing a kinship with the wild species of a raptor. And from there, all these years, I've always had a soul connection to birds of prey. Of course, now I'm not active in falconry. I represent birds of prey in my art as I paint, in hopes of the more educational value of their beauty and their abilities through my art and the country in which they live.
I'm just curious, what was it about the birds that caught you so directly?
Just something about just their majesty, just their strength. This, you know, there's nothing that feeds on a bird of prey. They're at the top of the pyramid. They're highly skilled predators, and there's nothing like the view of a bird of prey in pursuit of its prey, and the elegance in their flight, and the sheer strength and endurance in their pursuit of that prey. And to me, that just lifts my heart to be able to witness that, and to see a Paraguayan falcon drop out of the sky and almost 200 miles an hour and pluck a duck out of the air is just incredible.
Now, so you've been spending actually your whole life watching birds of prey, and working with them and living with them. And I also believe that at times you've had a few that you've had the opportunity to get to know on a kind of a personal level. When you get to know a bird like that, what's the connection? What's the communication like?
Well, when I was active in falconry, of course, I consider myself an ornithologist. I love bird watching of all kinds of birds now. And well, when I was active with the raptors, there was the kinship between a bird kept in by a falconer and this relationship of hunting in the wild with it is something that it's quite a sport, and it's quite a historical event that goes back a couple of thousand years. And it's just being a part of that and being able to look in that bird's eyes and feel the wildness and the beauty of it and watching it and taking care of it and making sure it doesn't get sick and caring for it and exercising it properly and having it on a proper diet, all of this is significant in its well-being, and to be fully involved with that is just a total thrill.
But you're also very much an artist. As a matter of fact, your work is displayed in the Kiva Gallery in Santa Fe on a regular basis, and word has it that you're kind of becoming a hot artist in that gallery. But let's go back, and I'm just curious, how did the art side of your relationship with the birds begin?
Well, ever since I was a child, my main interest was sketching and drawing. While other children were out riding bikes and whatever, I was more than content to sit on my living room floor and with a pad of paper and just do drawings pages after pages, and you know, trying to find what interests me and trying to find what kind of a challenge I could have to draw. And there's nothing more incredible than to even try and draw a feather, and there's just something about it that is just, you know, if it's properly done and it's very identifiable, it's a wonderful thing. And then incorporating the birds and their natural environment, and then get the love of the wildlife in nature and the vastness of this wonderful state that I live in. I mean, there's no place else you can just look and see for a couple of hundred miles, mountain ranges, and the air is so clean, and just the old combination of where I live and the abundance of the birds of prey and being able to find them was my main inspiration.
Now, so you started drawing. Did you draw with pencil or pen or what?
I started off with pencils, and, mm-hmm. and the more detailed I became with my pencil, the more I began to realize, well, I can get graphite or I can get a fine-tip drawing pen, and I could do some rapidograph work and really detail my pieces out. And it wasn't until high school that I really began to experiment with color and brushes and such.
Now, also, for people who are interested, I have some images of some of Rourke's work on the website, so you can see it there, but you can also visit the gallery, which is
KivaIndianArt.com.
They're in Santa Fe, and how long have they been working with you?
They've represented my work now for 7 years.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous.
And I've been shown exclusively through the Kiva Gallery, and things have just been getting better each year. I mean, some pretty prominent collectors are starting to pop up now and look at my work.
One of the things that I think it distinguishes your work from a lot of other bird painters, at least in my experience of your work, is the fact that you really do portraits of these animals. They stand tall and strong, look at you, and then they're backdropped by their native landscape. What inspires you to do it that way?
Well, growing up looking at Audubon's ability to paint and other representational bird artists, so to speak. Roger Torrey Peterson once quoted to me, he says, well, it's nice to see somebody that actually does raptors. And it's nice to do a study, I mean, to represent birds like Roger Torrey did or Audubon. To me, it seemed like I wanted to take it further. I wanted to actually show the type of trees that grew around them, the type of sandstone cliffs, the rock differences, the outcroppings that of the area that they lived, and so the incorporating of the birds of prey in their natural environment was something that, with huge amounts of distance, which you see out in this area, was not being done. And so I just took advantage of that. And usually what I do is I pinpoint a fine landscape and actually almost completely finished landscape. Then I incorporate the bird and move it around on the canvas, maybe do a cutout until I find the right composition and then paint it onto the landscape so it blends right in with it.
Give us an idea of some of the types of birds that you've actually featured in your art.
Well, I've done all species. The raptors, I've done red-tailed hawks, I've done golden eagles, prairie falcons, peregrines, cooper hawks, just different species. And one of my series I'm hoping to start probably this winter is a series of birds of prey found in the Pecos Valley where I live. Hopefully that will be inspiring to have an exhibition of this type of work at the National Monument, which is close to my home, and maybe have a showing there of wildlife birds of prey that people can actually see in the area. Wait until this train goes by.
We'll just listen to the train. That's a great sound.
Right on time between 2 and 2:30. The Amtrak from Chicago to California.
That's a great sound. Great sound.
Huh?
You live in a relative paradise. Just as an aside, by the way, you also live relatively close to the Pecos Monument, which historically was quite an amazing community there. Any thoughts about that? I know you know some of the history of that place, and it's a very powerful zone. Just as an aside.
Well, it was the Pecos National Monument became a national monument and was under the Preservation Act back in the 50s, and the people involved with that was the late Greer Garson, movie actress, and her husband Buddy Fogelson, who put the money up to build have it excavated and protected and reestablished as a national monument and a visitor center. The old Indian Pueblo that was there dates back to the 1400s, and then of course when the Spanish came in and built the churches and kind of ran the Indians' way of life and had them work for them and stuff, introducing Christianity and stuff. they built this huge mission, which during the revolt, Pueblo Revolt, was also burned and destroyed and rebuilt again on top of the old structure. So it has quite a history, and if anybody ever comes out here, they really must make plans to come by and see the Pecos National Monument. It's quite a historical place.
Yeah, it's a crossroads, really. It's an entree to the Great Plains, and lots of history there.
Yes, to pass through the Rocky Mountains into the Great Plains.
That's exactly right. But now, when you go about painting a bird, I'm just curious, how do you like to work? How do you study a bird to really understand how it fits?
Well, it depends. Like if I have a species in mind, then I do, of course, in my mind, I kind of put the composition together. Sit down with an empty canvas and kind of sketch out in a burn umber fashion of illustration the idea that I have in mind. Sometimes my ideas come to me in a dream, and I'll get up the next day and in the studio and put down what I saw in my mind. And then I, depending on the bird, type of bird, like prairie falcon, it'd be real open country with deep canyons and vastness and plains and everything. And then with the Cooper Hawk, which is a raptor that survives in a forested area, needs to have a different composition, which is forest and trees and mountains and you know, meadows and stuff like that. So it depends on the species I paint, and it depending on what type of landscape needs to go behind it.
Now, do you ever expect that these paintings have their own magic? That is to say, that when they're put in someone's home, perhaps they may send out that message of the importance of these creatures and the space and this planet to the people who have the good fortune of living with one of your works.
Well, I think so. I think hopefully that's, you know, it's something that when they walk in and see one of my pieces on the wall, it's something, you know, they feel like they're that close to that bird, and that bird is so accurately drawn that they can tell what it is. If they don't, they can look it up and say, oh, it's a prairie falcon, or it's a red tail, and they can see the country it's in and have the appreciation. So to me, hopefully it's a preservation of the environmental statement that I'm doing with my art. And people will collect it because of that, or initially enjoy the view that they see when they look at my painting.
One of the dynamics of your work is the fact that it is the bird, but it's also within the landscape, and your landscape paintings are getting a lot of attention these days as well. Let's talk about you and the land and how it is the land speaks to you.
The Southwest landscape to me is, I haven't traveled extensively. I've been to Colorado and Arizona, and they all have their own sort of variety of landscape changes and formations and horizontal differences. But New Mexico, to me, you can go from one end of the state to the other, and you're in completely different terrain. And to me, that's just incredible. And the seasons here are full. We've got full four seasons. I mean, it's cold in the winter, and it's hot in the summer, and in between, you got the moderate range, and it's just perfect. And that's why it's such a migratory route for the birds of prey to come through here, because especially the Rio Grande River, which is a main route for waterfowl and such, and of course the predators follow the source of food. But the land itself it speaks for itself. I mean, there's no place else you can stand on the hillside and look 100 miles and see a mountain range and have the ability to even go there within a day and explore that part of the state. And it's just and at night with the stars, I mean, there's no cloudiness, there's no pollution. You can, in my backyard, I can look up and the Milky Way is so bright you can almost touch it. And to me, there's no place else for me to live as an artist, for sure. And the furthest I've been away from home is Connecticut. I drove out to a wildlife show for the Nature Conservancy out there back in 1992. And that's the first time I've really been further east than Texas in my life. And we drove to Connecticut, my daughter and I. And I, to this day, I can still remember, I didn't see the blue sky or feel very well at all until I got back into the state of New Mexico on the way back and saw the blue sky again.
It is amazing for people who spend any time in New Mexico. That blue sky is legendary. It does affect one's soul, I think, you know. Mm-hmm. You're lucky in a sense that because you live in, entranced by your art and surrounded by the natural beauty there, and that's really very much what your life is involved with. But then there's other things happening on the planet out here that I'm sure you hear about once in a while. Some of the things that are happening in the oceans and to our forests, how do you bridge that? You know, how do you, when you think about the life that you represent and that you paint and express in your art, and then what's happening out there? What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, environmentally speaking, I'm very concerned about what's going on with the planet. I think everybody needs to have the awareness, or at least acknowledge the awareness of its importance, and you know, keeping our oceans clean and keeping our countryside open and publicly available for its beauty. And I really can't comment too much on oceans and things because I've never really spent that much time around large bodies of water. And any place in this country or anywhere else, I think people need to be aware of how they walk, how they travel, how they handle the earth that they walk upon, and what they do for, and how they can help to protect it and nourish it and feel responsible for it.
I don't want to get too political, but they're suggesting relaxing a lot of the endangered species laws. That could literally lead, if it weren't for the endangered species legislation, possibly a lot of your raptors may not be around. What would the loss be to the world if these birds and other creatures weren't here, your perspective?
It would just be a chain reaction. I mean, if these things are lost, then the things that they feed upon are going to overpopulate themselves, or there's going to be one reaction after the other. I mean, every time a species is lost, it causes a backlash of trauma through life. And if there's any way we can preserve and protect and make sure these things do not vanish from the earth, the better off we're going to be.
You know, I said this was going to be a relatively short interview, and I happen to know that, as a matter of fact, this Saturday, Rourke's going to get married.
Going to get married.
Yeah, that's great. What's the plan there?
Well, we've been planning it out for a while. There's going to be a lot of people here, and we're in the backyard right now digging an outhouse because I mean, it's something we can use afterwards, too, so I might as well just get a nice big one done for the convenience of the guests that are going to be around. And we're going to have just quite a hoedown here. We're going to have to build a stage. We're going to have, I'm a musician also, and play country songs and tunes and dance and just have a good time. And hopefully afterwards we're going to try and come out and see you, Sid.
That would be fabulous. I want to wish you a great joy in your life as you move on as a married man again. And also I want to invite people to visit your gallery. Why don't you talk about the gallery, where it is?
The gallery is located on the intersection of Water and Shelby Street. And it's a well-established gallery. Paula McDonald, the owner, is the finest representative I've ever known for anything. Anybody's art of any kind. I feel very fortunate that I'm represented with a group of fine artists. The majority are Native American, and with the likes of David John and Yellow Man and Ben Nelson, and you can see their fantastic works of art also on the net site. And Paula McDonald is just a wonderful person. The gallery is well established. And we get a lot of people through there, and I just feel so grateful to be a part of it.
One last thing, too. You work in a variety of sizes, and I think a size is interesting, and you're kind of working into some bigger size. You go from very small to very big. Let's give us a sense of what size people might be looking at if they were to see some of your work.
Well, I hardly do anything smaller than 5x7, and I that's on board. Anything small like that I do on gesso board.
5x7 inches.
Yeah, that's about the smallest I do now. And I make my own frames, and the larger pieces go all the way up to, I've got a couple of 36x60s I'm working on right now. And I have some 7-foot stretcher bars, which I'm planning to put together as soon as I build me a larger studio, so I'm getting kind of pressed for size here because I do want to do larger pieces, 4x5s and 5x8s and whatever. I'm get some calls for that, so we'll see what happens.
Well, I want to wish Rook Griffin, artist, a musician, and great soul, great success in your art and as well in your new life with your new bride.
Thanks, Sid. Keep in touch, and we'll see you soon.
The earth gives it all away, and it is a gift of beauty, peace, and wonder. Somehow, we must keep the dream alive that a time will return when people and their land and the wild, wonderful creatures are able to all take a deep, deep breath and find balance along the path. It's always a joy to walk and talk with you. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again each Thursday or anytime on the archives when the voice of the earth speaks again here on the Wild Side News.